get back, a listener sent me an article from the Mensa magazine, which weirdly I do not have a subscription to. I mean, I'm sure it was just an oversight on Mensa's part that I don't have a subscription to it. But it's an article, and I'll give you the subtitle so you understand where we're going with it. When candidates supplant reasoned debate with false arguments. And if this article doesn't clearly define this political cycle, I don't know what does, to be perfectly frank. So we're going to talk to the author, Tom Fournier, when we get back.
It's a new year and a new voice on KOA News Radio. Now, Mandy Connell on 850 AM and 94.1 FM.
KOA News Radio time 2:05, coming up on 2:06. An astute listener sent me an article. And I very much appreciate it because, weirdly, I'm not on the Mensa magazine mailing list. But a man named Tom Fournier wrote a really interesting article, at least I find it interesting, called Philosophy and Political Fallacy. And Tom joins me now to talk about it. Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for joining me.
Well, hi, Mandy. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I truly enjoyed your article because it reinforced an observation that I have had. Well, I didn't have it as eloquently as you had it in this article, but the observation is that, you know, politics at this moment in time seems to be people seeking out reinforcements for what they believe and accepting hook, line, and sinker arguments being made by candidates they support without any intellectual curiosity. And you laid it out in, as I said, a much more eloquent fashion, the sort of foundation for the philosophical issues that we're seeing play out, but not necessarily in a positive way. First of all, what inspired you to dig deep in terms of political debate versus philosophical debate and really the origins of debate and what it's become now?
Well, Mandy, the what inspired me was a decision to go back to school at a late age, and was looking for something to study that I hadn't studied earlier. So I've been living the American dream. I started my own company and built it up and sold it, retired, and was looking for something to do afterwards. So I wound up being the old man in the classroom at a local community college. I didn't know what I wanted to study. So I, just for the heck of it, took a philosophy class. Now, prior to that, I had a degree in engineering and another one in business. And so I wanted to do something totally different than what I had done in the earlier part of my life. I took a philosophy class. I loved it. I transferred to university and wound up spending several years going after a master's degree, which I finally earned, in philosophy. And along the way, you know, I wasn't quite sure what aspect of philosophy I wanted to study, but I did. I did come across a professor, Schmidt is his name, and David Schmidt, who runs the a very nice series of philosophical studies on what it means to be free, what is freedom, and of course part of that is tangential to politics because politics and government are all about freedom. So that's how I originally got interested in this.
That's an interesting comment, that politics and government are all about freedom. It feels less and less so as we move forward.
In a sense, it does. And some days I'm very frustrated as well and feel somewhat unfree. Of course, then I always look across the seas and see what's happening in other countries and go, well, I guess we're not as bad off. But the bottom line is I feel very strongly, I think like you do, Mandy, and that is that we're not very good as citizens. We're not very good at holding our own leaders up to scrutiny. And by that, I mean we seem to want to be categorized as either, liberals or conservatives. And then, so, okay, I'm on that team. That means that I can't criticize people or leaders on my team, and what that does over the long term is that the leaders get lazier and lazier. They use these fallacies, these ridiculous tactics in their arguments, and no one challenges them on it, or at least the people who do challenge them are the folks on the other side. And it's so easy to dismiss the folks on the other side, but it's harder for them to dismiss it if the people from their own group, their own team, are criticizing them.
I think that with the rise of social media, it has become more obvious than it ever was, because you see things, and this is very frustrating to me, because I have friends that I consider to be very intelligent across the political spectrum, and then I'll see somebody that normally I would agree with politically post some just nonsense, you know, ridiculous article that if they had taken 4 seconds to use the internet to either confirm or deny, they would have realized how ridiculous it was. But it was something that they wanted to believe was true. So instead of doing that and expending some intellectual curiosity and going and investigating whether or not it was accurate or not, they repost it. And then it creates this, you know, well, this friend posted it, so I trust him. And therefore, it's very lazy is what it is. And I find that frustrating.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's get into this article. This article is fantastic. And I warn my listeners that this is really nerdy, but I think it's really interesting to learn the big words for these things that we all know what they are, but we don't know the Latin words for them. So I appreciate you getting those Latin words together for me, Tom. So now I can look smart at my next cocktail party.
You bet. That's part of the deal here.
I think the point you made at the beginning of the article about the nature of debate, when if you've ever studied philosophy of at any level in college, whatever, you know, you go back to the Socratic method and you go back to the days where I just envision these men standing around on the steps of the temple having meaningful debates about large issues. But it wasn't always that way. It was for a while more like a blood sport, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Socratic. So it's Socrates himself. Was, if you will, a martyr for rational arguments. Yeah, 400 years before Christ, Athens, Greece was a democracy of sorts, in that in order to get something done, you had to stand in public and you had to debate, and the winner of the debate would get either realize his ambitions for power or wealth or a project he wanted to work on that required cooperation of the population. There were men in Athens at that time called the Sophists, and that means wise men. So it's arguable whether these people were really wise men. They were very, very talented debaters, is what they were, and they could actually make a living in Athens by teaching youth of the elite how to win arguments. Their whole tactic was not aimed at necessarily getting at the truth or finding the good in an argument. It was aimed at winning the argument, and this is where the term sophistication came from, from the Sophists. And the deal with Socrates is he was a genius. He was very able to disarm these folks by pointing out the fallacies in their arguments, and he was so good at it that eventually they charged him with treason and corrupting the youth of the nation, and sentenced him to death by forcing him to drink hemlock.
Now, I'm going to make a current day analogy to that situation, and that is, you know, we're now at a time in our society where if you say the wrong thing, yes, you're not poisoned with hemlock, but you can be thrown right off the island, to use a pop culture metaphor. I mean, if you say the wrong thing, you can lose your job, you can lose your livelihood, you can lose everything for saying the wrong thing. And yet here we have an example of when saying the right thing could get you in that same position. It seems like it wouldn't be too far of a leap from where we are now to getting to a place where, again, maybe not death with hemlock, but even saying the right thing and speaking out against the status quo could lead to dire consequences.
Well, in some cases, that's true. As you indicated, that, of course, we don't sentence people to death anymore, but political careers are won and lost. And jobs are won or lost by pointing out to the wrong person that, hey, you don't agree with what their candidate just had to say. All of a sudden, you find yourself on the way out of a company.
Well, I will tell you, last week, when Sarah Palin made her endorsement for Donald Trump, I made a comment about not caring what Sarah Palin's endorsement was. I happen to think endorsements are kind of silly at this point. I don't pay attention to anybody else's endorsements. But I got hate mail from people saying, oh, you don't like Sarah Palin, you're one of those. I mean, it was a little bit ridiculous, you know. It was to the point where if one comment is going to make you never listen again, I can't help you. You know, I can't help you. Let's get into the kinds of attacks that we see in politics. And in reality, Tom, you see these in life as well. I mean, anybody who's dealt with a difficult situation at work has probably heard some of these things. What have we've all heard of that I would venture that at least part of this audience doesn't know the actual meaning of is an ad hominem attack.
Correct.
And explain the ad hominem fallacy.
Okay, so the ad hominem, the phrase stands for against the person. So as you can get, it's a personal attack. And it's not that it's wrong to challenge someone's character and so forth under the right circumstances, but it's how you do it. So you might hear, here's an example of one, you might hear something like, well, candidate Boyd proposes drastic limitations on access to safe abortions, claiming that his pro-life stance is driven by a strong commitment to family values. Yet his commitment to family is hardly credible, given his admitted illicit affair.
So this is the politics of personal destruction, is it not?
Exactly. And,
yeah.
And here's what's bad about this. I mean, it's not that, I shouldn't say bad, improper. Here's what's improper about that attack. It's not just that, well, maybe it's not a fair thing to start dragging him over the coals over something that happened in his past. It's that you're preventing the argument from occurring. The argument that needs to occur is the proposal, about the proposal for drastic limitations on safe abortions. Are there good reasons to limit those or not? But instead of allowing people to conduct a reasoned debate about whether or not there are reasons, you find all of a sudden now we're arguing about the character of the person who brought up the subject instead of the actual subject that he's debating.
And that happens a lot. I mean, that happens so much. I mean, I'm sitting here ticking off examples in my mind where you can't even get to an actual conversation because of the nature of the dialogue around it, the sort of vitriol that goes around it. If you are perhaps opposed to abortion after the first trimester, well, then you're part of the war on women. That right. Kind of ideology, that kind of demagoguery, really. I mean, it's completely counterproductive, but doesn't it achieve its intent? And that is taking a logical, rational discussion into an emotional realm?
Well, it does, and that's the problem. Rather than debating issues now, we're debating moral character of individuals. And again, it's fine to debate moral character of individuals. We should ask ourselves, what kind of person do we want to lead us? Does she have a great character? Does he have a great character? Can we trust him? Those are all appropriate questions. But they're not appropriate when they're used to stop us from considering the proposals, the issues that the person is debating, because we need to debate those issues. We need to know where the candidates stand. If we can never get to it, then we're wasting our time.
Another one that I find interesting, I'd never heard the phrase argument ad populum, but I've certainly seen this strategy at work. Explain what argument ad populum is.
You bet. And by the way, thank you for reading the paper so far.
I loved it. I thought it was fascinating. And I wish I had saved the email from the listener who sent it to me so I could thank him on the air. It's a fantastic article. Like I said, I love the super nerdy stuff, and philosophy classes in college exploded my head every day, and I enjoyed them immensely. So this is sort of my wheelhouse. And I do think it's interesting. And the reason I wanted to have you on, Tom, is because I'm trying to get people to look at an issue from all sides in order to better determine the way to solve a problem. I'm a problem solver, and I think we get too caught up in name-calling and the other side is evil, regardless of what side you're on, and we're not ever addressing any of the significant issues that we have in this country. So if by forcing people to recognize how they're getting sucked into this stuff helps move that process along, I'm all for it. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. But let's talk about argument ad populum.
Okay, so ad populum, the term, as you might be able to kind of guess, populum, it stands for populace. So it's ad populum argument is appeal to the populace, and the appeal is generally made on an emotional level. So and the idea is that the person committing the fallacy is quite often on purpose trying to introduce emotionally charged content into the argument in order to stop people from even considering the proposal that's on the table. So let me give you an example. You might hear something like, well, leaving Afghanistan before the Taliban are defeated would mean that our soldiers who died gave their lives in vain. So think about what's happening in this argument. it's the thing needs to be rationally debated is when and under what circumstances should we leave Afghanistan. But you can't even start the debate if it means that by agreeing it's time to leave Afghanistan, you're in essence agreeing that our soldiers died in vain. In other words, there's an emotional content that's not necessary in order to evaluate the argument. Instead, we need to evaluate what's the status of the enemy. Are the locals able to take over for themselves? And by allowing this sort of ad populum argument, it hushes honest discourse about what we need to be debating, and it creates this emotional atmosphere that's hostile to any sort of reasoned dissent.
And I would argue that if someone is using this strategy, and once you start looking for it, it's very easy to see. I mean, this to me is the one that is employed the most. It should make you question the motivation of the person using this tactic, because if they don't want to have a conversation about the underlying issues and they immediately want to put you either in an offensive posture or a defensive posture, they're, in my mind, they either can't hang in the conversation or they're choosing not to. But either way, we're not going to accomplish anything using this kind of stuff. And this happens all the time on both sides of the aisle, big time.
Well, yeah, actually, I don't want to give your listeners the wrong impression. The paper that I wrote, I was very careful in every single one of these to present an example from the left and an example from the right.
Right.
So they understood that just, let me give you an example from the left on the very same ad populum argument. You might hear something like, well, allowing corporations to pay huge executive bonuses is just one more tactic on the war on the middle class. Well, only a very despicable person would want there to be a war on the middle class.
Right.
So all of a sudden, if you want to present any rational argument for why executive bonuses are necessary, you're branded as being a warrior against the middle class.
And that is an issue that I have run up, and I'm sure everybody's run up against, where if you say, hey, I believe we need to reform the welfare system. This is my example. I believe we need to reform the welfare system because I don't necessarily think keeping people on the dole forever is good for them or good for society. I am branded as being a horrible person who hates the poor. And that's an actual example. And I think to myself, of course, I don't hate the poor. I've been poor. I know what it's like to be broke. And I also know what it's like to crawl your way out of it with hard work and a good hand up and things of that nature. But you can't get past the argument if the other side has branded you as everything but a child of God at this point. I mean, it doesn't work that way. But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, that's why they do it.
That's exactly why they do it, so that you don't dare continue on with the argument for fear of being branded.
And it's been very successful in some cases. Luckily for me, I don't care. That's the big issue. Now, Tom, when you started looking at this, how has this impacted your viewing? And I don't know your political persuasion, because in this paper, you are very careful to, you do give great examples on both sides of the aisle. But has this changed the way you listen to candidates, just being so hyper aware of all this? Or is this something you've kind of been keen to previously, and now you're just kind of putting it all on paper?
So yeah, I can't honestly say that I was keen to it prior to having studied philosophy and being introduced to the philosophy of freedom by David Schmitz at the University of Arizona. Once I spent many months in several of his classes studying this, I became keenly aware of sorts of fallacies that go on in politics. I mean, I was having my buttons pushed and strings pulled on a regular basis by politicians in terms of getting me whipped up with these sort of ad populum, ad hominem attacks, and many, many other types. And I can say that, having studied that, the philosophy, I gained a much, much greater appreciation for the ethical systems that are behind each one of the political systems that the different parties adhere to. I can tell you I've become much, much more centrist as a result of having studied it, because I've developed an appreciation for when the left is wrong and when the right is wrong.
Right. We're talking with Tom Fournier. He has written a fantastic article. By the way, I did something I hardly ever do. I put a PDF on the blog today because there's no link on the Mensa website. So there's a PDF of the entire article. Tom, can you hang around? And I want to get into, there's a couple more segments of this. I really just want people to understand how they are being manipulated, because ultimately this is all about manipulation. Can you hang around?
Sure.
Okay, hang on 1 second. I'm talking with Tom Fournier. KOA News Radio time, 2:36. Don't forget, if you want to follow the Broncos to the Super Bowl, go to primesport.com/Denver Broncos for your official Broncos Super Bowl travel package to San Francisco. That's primesport.com/Denver Broncos. They have packages that include everything, airfare, accommodations, ground transport, and even access to the official Broncos pregame tailgate. It's a great deal. Go to visit primesport.com, or rather go primesport.com/Denver Broncos and go to the Super Bowl today. Now, I'm having a conversation with Tom Fournier, who wrote an excellent article in the Mensa magazine, which I'm sure all of you get, but I don't get it. But it struck me as something I want to talk about, because we in the political audience, whether you are a Democrat or you are a Republican, are treated to a level of dialogue that is really not necessarily productive, and it is designed to invoke an emotional reaction rather than really get down and solve difficult issues. And Tom has written a wonderful article, Philosophy and Political Fallacy, When Candidates Supplant Reason Debate with False Arguments. And we're kind of going through some of the various ways that politicians manipulate the language and manipulate us as voters to get their intended result, which is to shut down their opponents, to demonize their opponents, and to put you in a position where you are having an emotional reaction to something that isn't necessarily or should not necessarily be an emotional situation. That's my thumbnail sketch of what we've already talked about, Tom. And now I want to go into my favorite named thing that I've never heard of in my life, Ignoratio Elanchi. What is this, and what is it? How does it come into play in politics?
Okay, Mandy. So it's Ignoratio Elanchi. I know.
I got to remember that. I'm writing it down because I'm using this at a cocktail party to just confuse people.
Well, it translates into ignorance of the refutation. But basically what it means is ignoring the argument. And there's actually a family of these kinds of fallacies. And so the Elanchi fallacy straw man is one that we hear quite often. And red herring is another one that we hear quite often. So I'll explain the straw man fallacy. So the straw man fallacy is when you take opponent's position, and you extrapolate it to some unintended extreme. So you take a little bit and push it way to its limit, and then say, "Oh, so that's what this candidate is claiming." So here's how you might hear it. Maybe a proposal from the right to reduce corporate tax in an effort to spur economic growth would be unfairly extrapolated by the left as intending to force 99% of the population to become subservient to the 1% of the wealthiest. So what's going on here is you're supposed to be debating, or the intent was that the right-minded candidate was offering something that is perhaps legitimate. Reduce corporate tax rates, it'll spur the economy, and then we'll all benefit. But instead of debating whether or not that would work, you find yourself debating this unintended consequence or this unintended extrapolation of the wealthiest 1% of the country holding 99% under their thumb, and that's obviously not what the original candidate meant. So what this does is it's a purposeful creation of this fictional straw man, and it's a straw man that's very easy to bludgeon. And it forces the victim of the fallacy to wind up having to defend against a preposterous position that they never intended to begin with.
And at that point, you've also successfully demonized your opponent by making them seem far worse, more extreme out there than they are in reality.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That is the red herring. Let's talk for a moment about our others. Mike Rosen just walked in and confused me there for a second. When the brains of the operation walks in, I got confused there for a second. What are the other types of Ignoratio Elanchi?
Okay, so that first, the one I just gave was the straw man.
Right.
That's, That's the one that extrapolates the position to an unintended extreme.
Right.
The next one is the red herring, and it does a similar thing. It draws the attention away from the argument from the debate that's supposed to be occurring. So the red herring term actually comes from hounds hunting foxes. So imagine, you know, you want to discourage someone's hound from getting to the fox first. And so what you do is you take this smelly fish and you drag it across the trail of the game so that as the hounds run down the trail, they get confused, they smell the fish, they start chasing the trail of the fish rather than chasing the game. And in politics, this is done all the time. And I can give you a couple different examples. One would be, for example, a proposal to increase government assistance for college tuition in an effort to spur higher education of the underprivileged. It might be met from the right by some sort of an exclamation like, well, these sorts of liberal tax and spend policies have ruined our country. So in this exchange, the red herring is the claim that the country is ruined. And so rather than having a debate about, well, what's the reason not to increase or not to assist college, or what are the reasons to assist college tuition? Instead of having that debate now, we wind up having a debate about whether or not the country is ruined. Now, I can give you another example from the left. So you might hear something like a proposal to implement broader communication surveillance in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. It might be met from the left. And in fact, I think at one point it was. By a comment like, well, if you people are so committed to protecting our citizens from physical harm, then why do you refuse to support regulations that curb the unhealthy content that's forced on us by the fast food industry? So, you know, again...
And at that moment, you've changed the conversation so completely that it almost seems ridiculous for you to actually go back and try and argue the first point.
Exactly. And the thing, the red herring that's thrown on the table is so smelly, it's so inflammatory, that it's hard to resist moving into that argument. And all of a sudden you find yourself arguing about the fast food industry when we ought to be talking about what the proposal was that was initially put on the table. And that is, do we need more communication surveillance or don't we?
You know, this whole conversation, Tom, just makes me feel like a giant rube on occasion. You know, it makes me feel like, because you can see it happening. I mean, you see it in the way politicians, and maybe it's because I've now known enough politicians that will say something privately, but they will position it completely differently on the campaign trail. And you know that they have been coached and they have been instructed by political operatives on what is going to have the biggest impact in terms of moving the electorate in the direction in which you want them to go. And
exactly.
A lot of the times, that's not logic. This is one of my great frustrations. It is the emotional knee-jerk reaction that is going to inspire people to do whatever it is these various politicians want us to do. And I would say, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, these are my words, I would say what we're seeing with Donald Trump is a perfect example of that. I mean, talk about a guy whose appeal is so emotionally driven that the substance underneath this appeal is significantly lacking, and yet he has engendered such passionate support from people who have applied their own logic to what it is he's saying, even though there may be no logic underlying what he is actually saying.
Understood. And I think you hit the nail right on the head in terms of coaches in the background. So
yeah.
we like to think that all of our candidates on both sides are coming up with everything on their own. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, they have to surround themselves with people to help them, you know, along the way, to advise them. And these are essentially the modern-day sophists, the ones that they surround themselves with, the people that teach them and coach them on how to win an argument, not necessarily how to present truth or come to a solution that is the good for the country.
I've had conversations with candidates who shall remain nameless, none of them running for president, where I asked specifically about a significant issue that was facing the community in which they were running. And when I said, why are you not talking about this? This is so important, so critical, and it's going to matter. It's going to matter. It's going to hit people on a personal level in their pocketbook. And they've come back and said, well, it doesn't poll well. And it makes my head explode. It truly makes my head